Ananda-sya Jnananjana-chalakaya chakshurun militam jena Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prishtaya Bhutale Srimate Bhaktivedanta Swami Niti Namine Namaste Saraswati Deve Gauravani Pracharine Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Pasyatyate Shatarine Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhara Srivasati Gaur Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare I am very, very honored and grateful to be with all of you today. Thank you, Kent, and this Conscious Living Club, and special gratitude to each and every one of you for choosing to be here when you have so many other alternatives at this moment. I'm quite astonished that I'm at Hewlett-Packard Enterprise, considering my very simple existence. One of the most powerful, influential companies in all the world. And I was told we just had a flood. And I was told there's a lot of changes in your company, and sometimes there's some stress also. And I was asked to speak on that subject. I live in Mumbai, and during the monsoons, we are very accustomed to floods. I have seen through the main streets of Mumbai, the only vehicles that can go down the streets during some of those floods are rowboats. And somehow or other, people just go on with their lives. It's human nature. When we expect things to go the way we want them to go, we are certain to be frustrated in due course of time. That especially holds true in the relationships we have with each other. If we can accept the events for what they are, if we can accept the people we're dealing with for who they are, and we really try to be ourselves instruments of positive change in that situation, then in that sense, we actually really have some control over the inner experience of our life. We have some control over our destiny and over how we can affect others. I remember learning this lesson when I was about 9 years old. My father, he was born of immigrant parents who came from Eastern Europe. His parents didn't speak a word of English. During the Depression, you know, they really had nothing. My father had to leave high school at the age of about 14 to work full-time just to help the family to buy some day-old bread to survive. But somehow or other, he really worked hard. And in 1958, he established with his brother a company that he was so proud of. He took so many loans and he worked so hard and invested literally every single thing he had in this company. It was the largest automobile dealership of a particular brand of cars in the whole of Chicagoland. The name of the car was the Edsel. Have any of you heard of that? It was the biggest disaster in automobile history. My father to this day says they were ahead of their time. But anyways, he went into total bankruptcy. He lost everything. And my mother, such a sweet, loving lady, she had to take care of three wild sons while my father was working and working. He would leave at 6 a.m, sometimes come home at midnight, just trying to somehow or other save from losing our little house. We were trying to take away everything. Struggling. And he didn't have the greatest discrimination, because after the Edsels, he went into another business, selling a car called a Studebaker. And that didn't work either. But anyways, I remember I shared a bedroom with my younger brother, and it was right next to the one bathroom in our house. And every morning, my father would be in the shower, and he would sing the same song. And I wondered why he sang that song every day. And he sang it with such feeling, like he really believed in what the words of this song were going to be. But as I grew up, I understood how hearing him in his shower made a great impact in my life, how I see the world. Would you like to hear the song? I'm not going to try to sing it, but I'll tell you the words. It was recorded by Al Jolson. It was from a long time ago. It's a popular song. When April showers, they come your way, they bring the flowers that bloom in May. So keep looking for that bluebird and listening for his song whenever April showers come along. So you've had some showers here. My father has some serious showers in his life. But the idea is he was looking for the possible opportunities that are there. He wasn't seeing the negative. The negative was all around, but he was looking for the positive opportunity in that situation. And this is a universal principle. In the Bible, it is said, seek and ye shall find. Knock, and the door will open. So if we're looking for reasons to complain, if we're looking for reasons to give up, if we're looking for reasons to really be distressed about events, we will find limitless opportunities. We will find every excuse. If we're looking how we can grow in this situation, how we can improve in this situation, we will find those two, because they are always there. Winston Churchill said that the definition of success is to go through failure after failure after failure and not give up the enthusiasm to succeed. That in itself is the success. Thomas Edison was working on a particular invention and he failed several hundred times. And a newspaper reporter asked him, "Aren't you getting discouraged?" He said, no, every time I fail, I'm getting more encouraged. Because I know one more way that it doesn't work. That means I'm closer to understand how it does work. So they're saying the same thing. The common analogy is you can see a half empty glass or a half full glass. It's the same glass, but your perception is either going to encourage you or discourage you. And that's very much the way life is. Could I tell you a story that really moved me? It's a true story. In 2012, I was driving from our ashram where I live in downtown Mumbai to the airport to come to America, through London. And usually that's the time that the people in the car with me really tell me the most difficult problems they're facing and asking me for answers. Because I'm not going to be back for a couple months. So I told him, please tell me an inspiring story, nothing else. So this person told me a story that he had just heard that day in an auditorium. It was International Women's Day. And during that year in New Delhi, there was some young ladies who were raped, and there was a huge outcry of demonstrations, not only in India, but in various parts of the world. So this particular event was really relevant. And the keynote speaker came up to the podium to speak. She was a 63-year-old lady, dressed in a simple sari. When she spoke, there were hundreds of people in this auditorium. There were politicians, there were very, very successful leading industrialists, business people, educators, doctors, lawyers. Everyone was crying as she spoke. She told her story. She was from a little village, Maharashtra, a very poor village financially. She wanted so much to go to school. When she was just 5 years old, her parents really couldn't afford to send her to school. They sent her out to herd the water buffaloes. A little five-year-old girl with a little stick with these gigantic water buffaloes. And during a part of the day, in the heat, the water buffaloes would go in the water to cool off up to their necks, and she would run to school. She said that oftentimes the teacher would beat her for being late. Then after she went through some classes, she ran out to get the water buffaloes, and sometimes the water buffalo would go into some other farmer's plot of land, and they would beat her. She said these were the happiest days of her childhood. When she was less than 10 years old, she was forced to marry a 30-year-old man. By the time she was 19 years old, she had three sons and was pregnant with another child. At that time, there was like a local land mafia, and this one person who was the leader was really exploiting the village ladies, forcing them to work and paying them practically nothing. This particular lady, whose name is Sindhu Thai, she reported this person to the district collector who oversees the police. And they stopped his activities. But this person was so angry, he told Sindhutai's husband blatant lies. He said, "Your wife, she is having affairs with so many other men, including me. In fact, she's pregnant, not with your son, with my son. And if you don't do something about her, I'm going to do something to you." The husband, out of fear, out of rage, he kicked his wife in the stomach again and again and again until he was convinced that she was dead. She was laying unconscious on the ground. He dragged her body into a crowded cow shed so that the people would think that a cow trampled her to death. One particular cow stood over her and protected her from all the other animals stepping on her. For hours, when she finally came back to consciousness, she saw this cow just pushing everyone else away and not allowing anyone to harm her, even humans. The cow chased humans away too. Under the cow, she gave birth to a baby girl. And the cows protected her, right above her, for several hours. She said she found a rock and cut her umbilical cord. And when she finally had enough strength with the baby in her arms, she embraced that cow and promised, "As you protected me when I was helpless, I am going to protect the helpless." She went back to her home, her biological home. But according to some tradition, they rejected her. "Once you move into your husband's home, you cannot come back to our home." She was homeless. She had an infant daughter. She was young, nice looking. She was afraid. She could be exploited. She went to a crematorium under the open sky on a riverbank, and that's where she would sleep at night. Because her strategy was, people will think I'm ghostly haunted and they won't bother me. And she explained in this talk at this auditorium that I'm speaking about that sometimes she was so desperate for food, she would beg some wheat flour, mix it with the river water, and cook chapatis or bread on the fire of the burning bodies at the crematorium. After some weeks, she was so depressed, she decided, "I don't want to live, and I don't want my daughter to live in this world either." And she made a decision to take her life. She went to a railway track and laid down with her little daughter in her arms, waiting for the train to crush her. At that time, she happened to hear a very old man crying for help. She got up, and the man was starving for water and food. So she went out and got some water and food for him. She begged it, and he was so grateful. She said that she heard the voice of God through this man's cries, that she had a purpose to go on living. She could do something for others. Later on, it was about noon, and she was just sitting in a field. The sun was blazing hot. She was thinking, "I want to help people. off, like the cow helped me. I felt the satisfaction of helping that old man by saving his life, but what am I going to do? I'm completely broken. And as she was thinking like this, she explained the tree she was under, there was a branch. That branch was chopped in so many ways by a woodsman. It was kind of hacked and chopped and butchered. And it was just hanging by a single shred. But it was giving her shade. And he was giving her a little baby shade. She was thinking, however abused and beaten I've been, still, I can serve others. She got that life-changing message of hope from that branch. And she went out and started finding little orphan children who were homeless. There's no shortage of those in India. And she protected them the best she could. She learned how to sing beautifully spiritual songs. And through her singing, she would beg and get enough donations to feed the children. After some time, she became known as the mother of the orphans. And some people, they built an orphanage for her. She had a building. And then a second and a third. And as time went on, Sindhu Thai had over 1,000 children. She was their mother. And she gave them education, love, and care. Things that she never received herself. She's won over 270 awards internationally. She's been invited to speak in 15 countries. Her students, or the helpless orphan children that she raised, most all of them are doctors, lawyers, engineers, farmers, in business. Two of her sons left their father to join her. They have PhDs. One of them did his PhD thesis on the life of his mother. Then she explained to the audience the most meaningful thing she ever did in her life. She said, decades after she was brutally beaten and rejected like trash, a man over 80 years old came to the orphanage. He was homeless. He was sick. He was starving. He begged for help. After a few minutes, she recognized this was her ex-husband who tried to murder her. He asked forgiveness. She forgave him. She said, I'm not your wife anymore. My role was only a mother. You can be my son. She brought him to the orphanage. And she told the children that give him your love because he needs it more than anyone. And sometimes when guests would come, she would say, this is my eldest son. And very naughty indeed. She explained how the capacity to forgive him and help him was the most meaningful, fulfilling experience in her whole life. Then she told the audience that challenges will come in our life, but we all have the capacity to rise above them and grow. She said, the path of my life was covered with thorns. I made friends with those thorns. And my life became simple and beautiful. After I heard this story, I was in New York City. And I looked her up on the internet and found out a few more details. And I gave a lecture about her, something like I'm giving to all of you here at Hewlett-Packard. And somehow or other, one of her students showed her a YouTube of me speaking about her in New York. So she contacted me. We met in her room, and she brought two of her grown orphan children with her. And we spoke for about an hour together, just sharing our realizations and our experiences. And it was just a beautiful meeting. And in the end, I was about to leave. And we thanked each other. And I happened to notice there was a young lady sitting next to her through the whole exchange that we had. This young lady was always smiling. She was lit up with a certain type of happiness that was really sweet and touching to the heart. And I asked Sindhutai, you know, who is this? And she said, oh, let me introduce you to her. This is one of my daughters. She is a medical doctor. She oversees one of my orphanages. In fact, she said, she's the one that was born under the cow. And she started to cry. And I started to cry. And the girl was just smiling. To me, this story really helps to put into perspective the challenges that we have in our life. We tend to think so many little things are so big. But if we're looking for positive opportunities, we can see them everywhere. And Sindhutai feels that her life is God's grace because she has seen how it has given so much hope to so many people to overcome the little obstacles that they may have. Living in India, recently we have a hospital and they went to Nepal and there was that massive earthquake. And seeing those people, they lost their parents, their children, their home, their businesses, no insurance. But just to receive some kindness from someone gave them so much meaning and hope. And many of those people came down to Mumbai to meet me. And they were finding such deep purpose and meaning in their lives in the opportunity to help people who were suffering the way they suffered. If a house has a strong foundation, it remains stable even through sunny and stormy times. This beautiful building of Hewlett-Packard in this auditorium, we we may really appreciate and discuss the architecture. We may discuss the different types of furnishings, the color combinations. But how many of us are aware of the importance of the foundation? We don't usually think about it because we don't see it. But the fact is, everything is depending on that foundation. If we have an inner, strong foundation within ourselves, then the inevitable storms that will come within our life, in our world, we will not only remain stable, but we'll grow. Challenges are the greatest opportunities to improve. Find within ourselves and within others that place of strength that's really critical for a fulfilling and purposeful life. I follow a path called Bhakti Yoga. The word yoga means union. It's a Sanskrit word. To find harmony with our body, our mind, with the living force that's within us. What is that living force? Who am I? This is the basic teaching of the Bhagavad Gita. And it's a universal teaching. That living force within me is seeing through my eyes, hearing through my ears, tasting through my tongue. We were little infant children, and then we witnessed our childhood, our adolescence, our middle age. Some of us are getting old. Who is the witness? The body's always changing, and the mind changes a lot. You don't have to give any examples about that. One day you can be just so happy and then one little thing happens, one person says something, you stub your toe and your whole day's ruined. The mind is like that. But who is that constant witness of all the changes of the body and mind? In the Gita it's called the Jivatma, the living force. Soul. In the Bible it said, what profit is a person if they gain the whole world but lose their own soul? The soul is beyond birth, beyond death. The soul is satchit ananda, eternal, full of knowledge and full of happiness. And what is that happiness that is within ourselves? This is such an important principle. Emerson, who was a great author, he wrote that the reason that the world is in such heaps of crisis and dissatisfaction and division is because people are disconnected from their own inner selves. There's a saying that in a cultured society, people love people and they use things. But unfortunately, in today's world, people are prone to love things and use people to get them and keep them. That is a very, very shallow, unsatisfying life. It's very disconnected from our own nature. things could give some pleasure to the body and the mind, but they can give no satisfaction to the heart. There's only two things that give fulfillment to the heart: to love and to be loved. I saw a little boy, and his parents were extremely wealthy, and they were constantly buying him new games and toys, and many of them were computerized, and he really knew how to use them. But after a week or two of any toy, he was frustrated and demanding something new. He bought him tens of thousands of dollars worth of things to try to play with. He was never happy for long. And then I visited somebody's house, and I saw a little girl, and she was playing with an avocado seed. And she was completely blissful. She was using her creative brilliance to invent all kinds of wonderful things out of this avocado seed. She was making it like a ball, she was making it like a doll, she was so many things. Why was she so happy with such a simple thing? Because she was loved by her parents. She felt secure. Because she felt inner satisfaction of being loved, she could be happy with anything. The little boy, the parents had no time to give him love. They just gave him things. And therefore nothing could satisfy him. That's everyone's nature. There's an analogy of a crane. A crane's a bird. He stands on one leg and he looks down in a running stream of water. And so many little fish are passing by. And the crane just watches. Hundreds of fish, little fish. Thousands of little fish. The crane just watches. And as soon as there's a big fish, he eats it. Now, what's the meaning of that story? Personally, I don't eat fish. I'm a vegetarian. But cranes do. The idea is that in this world, we are constantly being bombarded by weapons of mass distraction. So many little things come in our life that can distract us. One word, one circumstantial situation can really make us disturbed. It can ruin our day. But if we're actually looking for the really important factors of life, if we're focusing our attention on those, and all the little unpredictable changing disturbances that come and go, they don't really disturb us. We just deal with them. When I was a little boy, my mother one day told me that everyone loves your father, and everyone loves me. She said, but we don't love each other anymore. We have decided to separate. I think I was about 8 or 9 at the time. And that was inconceivable to me. I felt so totally disoriented. My mother and father don't like each other and they're going to leave each other. I felt like the whole world was kind of dropped out from under me and I was just falling into an endless space. It was so confusing to me. I didn't say a word, I just cried. And when my mother saw me in that state, she was really disturbed. But then I did something that disturbed her even more. I jumped up off her bed where I was sitting, and I ran out her door, I ran down the stairs, I ran out of our front door, and I ran down the street, and I ran for blocks. Hours later, my father drove in from work, and I knew my mother was going to tell him what I did. So when they went into their bedroom, I secretly went outside the door and put my ear on the door to hear what they were going to speak about. My mother told my father what happened. I heard complete silence. And then they said to each other that for the higher principle of our children, we are going to make this marriage work. Whatever differences we have with each other, whatever ways we're agitating and disturbing each other, we're going to work it out because we have a higher purpose. It wasn't easy for them. But you know what I witnessed? After some years, I had never seen such a bond of love between two people. They earned it by focusing on something higher. They were focused on that big fish. And they were willing to deal with the little fish for what they were. Mind has the tendency to make a little piece of sand look like a mountain. But if we're actually seeing the mountain, we see the sand for what it really is. How to deal with stress? How to deal with change? They will come. If our happiness is dependent on things not happening the way we don't want them to happen, then we're not going to be very happy for long. Happiness is not circumstantial. Happiness is a state of mind. And that's where the journey within. Through meditation, through prayer, through a balanced life. In the tradition I follow, there's three principles we try to apply. Satsang, sadhana, and sadachar. And I'm going to end in a moment. Just like you're watching television. When I was a little boy, there was four stations in Chicago. NBC, ABC, CBS, and
UBS.
And now I go to my father's house, and my God, you know, he has this little remote, and there's like 100 channels. You just press a channel, and there, you know, there's a football game in Dallas, Texas. Press another channel, and there's, you know, news from Baghdad. Another channel, and there's a soap opera from New York City. And all of you are very scientific, technological-oriented people, but I'm just a simple Swami. To me, it's really fascinating. How is it you just press a button and you get a different sound and a different picture? It's not that you know, call on your on a phone and order please send me this station. Just a button. That means those frequencies are all around. And all those different frequencies is all around. And according to what you tune into is what you're going to access. Within the world today, there are so many frequencies. There's the frequency of depression, there's the frequency of greed, there's a frequency of arrogance, there's a frequency of selfishness, there's the frequency of anxiety and stress, there's frequency of goodness and charity. There's the frequency of grace. And what we tune into is what we're going to access. And what we tune into, we become like antennas. Then we emit that frequency. If we tune into the grace, to the positivity, that's actually within us and all around us. We generate that positiveness wherever we are, whoever we're with. And anyone could be positive when everything's positive. But it takes a special person to be positive when there's negativity around. And that's the person who's truly a leader. That's the person who's truly going to be remembered within the world in positive ways. And we all have that potential. To be with positive people. To engage, to put some time a day for our yoga or our prayer or our meditation. We chant God's names. To tune in to that positive energy of grace. And then in whatever we do, we can actually be expressing the true wealth we found. I was speaking to a CEO of a major corporation in Chicago, and I told him, there's a proverb that you can tell how rich you are by counting how many things you have that money cannot buy. And he said, that's so true. And for about 10 minutes, he was telling me all the things that are important in life that money cannot buy. And I said, you came to meet me in a private jet, and I hitchhiked to come to meet you. I said, if all the good things in life money can't buy, why do you work so hard for money? And he smiled. He said, because it's nice to have the things that it can buy. And I actually thought that was a really good balance. We may be working, and we have to work. We have our families, and we have our, you know, our goals to achieve. But it shouldn't be that we're depending on the results for our happiness. Our happiness should be coming from within ourselves. From within our very souls, by feeling God's limitless love and being an instrument of that love through our work, through our relationships. And then stress, a weightlifter, the more stress, the stronger they get. A runner, as the lungs are pumping, he gets stronger. Education, they give us exams. It's a stress. If we learn how to balance and manage the stressful conditions of this world with that inner enlightenment, with that inner satisfaction that we have, all of us have, then we become stronger and stronger. The redwood trees, they live through, in Northern California, through massive earthquakes, and massive windstorms and snowstorms, and they just keep growing. The underground secret of the redwood tree is just underground, the roots. They grow out to meet the roots of other trees. And as soon as they meet, they wrap around each other and embrace, a permanent embrace. In this way, every tree on the root level is supporting every other tree. And they just keep growing through the storms and the earthquakes because there's a deep connection they have with each other. As companies, as humanity, true fulfillment of life is when we learn how to find our own inner satisfaction and we reach out with share and care for each other. And then whatever the world may bring, we just grow and we grow and we grow. Thank you very much.